Okay, let's unpack this. When we talk about experience, what do we really mean? Is it just, time on the
For
job?
something much more specific, yeah.
And what about talent? Is that something you're born with, or is it something you actively build?
Big questions.
Yeah. So today we're doing a deep dive into how real expertise actually develops, the surprising sort of cognitive stuff going on behind the scenes, and where things like AI really fit in.
Right.
And this isn't just theory, right? We want you to find practical insights here, things you can use to be, well, better informed and maybe more effective.
Exactly. And the sources you shared, they offer this really fascinating, almost counterintuitive look at expertise. It draws from all over the place: firefighting, chess, military command, even music.
Right, diverse fields.
Yeah, and this deep dive, I think, is going to challenge some really common assumptions people hold. It turns out genuine expertise is often built in ways you probably wouldn't expect.
Okay, so let's start with one of those big assumptions. This idea that expertise just piles up over time, like you just clock in the hours.
Yeah, the 10,000-hour rule sort of simplified things maybe too much.
Right, forget just clocking hours. Our sources are saying it's actually forged through specific, sometimes kind of counterintuitive cognitive processes, things you can actually work on.
Exactly. Active processes.
And here's where it gets really interesting. Most people think AI, it's coming to replace human abilities. But what our sources seem to reveal is a much more nuanced role, maybe even more powerful in some ways.
Well, the core insight seems to be this: AI can definitely help you think more systematically around your actions.
Yeah.
It can help prepare, help reflect.
Okay.
But, and this is the key thing, it absolutely cannot replace the real-world action you need to build true judgment under pressure.
Can't simulate stakes, really.
Right. Nor can it, develop authentic relationships or foster that deep emotional resilience or earn a genuine reputation. Those things, they happen all at once, recursively, feeding back into each other. It's not some neat linear process you can just automate.
So, if AI can't give you that judgment under fire or build those crucial relationships, is it just a fancy spell checker then? Or is there still a practical, impactful role?
Oh, it's far more than a spell checker. Think of it more like an elite training partner for the cognitive side of things.
Okay, how so?
Well, it can help you prepare for conversations, maybe draft communications, even rehearse difficult discussions, run through scenarios.
Oh, okay, like a simulator for the thinking part.
Exactly. It can give you immediate critique on your logic, your approach. It can help you process setbacks, maybe reframe challenges, plan your next steps.
That sounds useful.
It is. And it can polish your communication, test how different phrasing might land. But, and here's the crucial caveat again, AI's critique isn't the same as real-world
Right.
consequences.
No skin in the game.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It can't replicate that feeling or build genuine resilience that only comes from, well, actually failing sometimes and picking yourself back up. That still
Right.
needs you in the arena.
Okay, that makes sense. So, speaking of building that genuine expertise, for a long time there was this huge debate, right? Nature versus nurture.
Oh, yeah, the talent debate.
Is exceptional performance down to inherited natural ability, or is it something else entirely?
Well, that innate talent idea, it's simple, it's attractive, but recent research really challenges it directly. Our sources cite studies arguing pretty strongly against rigid genetic factors just determining your maximum performance, even for physical stuff in sports or, brain capacity.
Really? Even physical attributes.
Yeah, I mean, look at history. Human performance keeps improving. Think about marathon times. The winning time in the 1896 Olympics. It was just about a minute faster than the qualifying time needed for big marathons like Boston today.
Wow, that's a huge difference.
Or typing speed. World championship speed improved by 80% between 1904 and 1923. Just think about that leap.
Okay.
And get this, Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto. When it came out, the best violinists of the day literally said it was unplayable.
No way.
Yep. And now, it's standard repertoire for any elite violinist. It's something they have to be able to play.
So if it's not just innate talent magically appearing, what does this mean for how we actually get good at things? How do we build that kind of mastery?
It points directly toward this idea of deliberate practice.
Deliberate practice,
It's a
very
very
much.
specific thing, a highly structured activity where the explicit goal is improving performance, nothing else.
So not just playing for fun.
No, it involves inventing specific tasks to target your weaknesses and carefully monitoring your performance, looking for those cues for improvement. And crucially, it's often not inherently enjoyable.
There's the catch.
Yeah. It doesn't generate immediate applause or money. It takes real effort, serious concentration, and long-term commitment.
So this deliberate practice, it sounds like, well, like hard work, not exactly kicking back with Netflix then.
Agrees. Not usually, no.
What are the practicalities? How does this actually play out?
Well, typically the development starts maybe with playful activities. A kid shows some interest, maybe seems good at something.
The natural talent appears.
Right. Or at least that's how parents often perceive it. That then leads to maybe some instruction, some limited deliberate practice. And interestingly, parents often tend to focus their resources, time, money for lessons, on just one child they see as special.
Yeah, you see that.
And for the real elite performers, the effective daily practice time is actually pretty limited, usually around 2 to 4 hours a day.
Only 2 to 4 hours, I'd have thought more.
Well, it's incredibly taxing mentally, any more than that. And you risk exhaustion, burnout. Quality over quantity. This is a big contrast with, say, music teachers or amateurs who might spend less time in that intense, focused solo practice each week.
Okay, wait. So you're saying even world-class athletes, their incredible physical abilities,
they
aren't just born that way. Their bodies actually adapt because of the training.
That's what the research suggests, yeah. Things like larger heart size or specific muscle development in elite athletes are often results of adaptation to years of intense training, not just a genetic blueprint they started with.
That's really counterintuitive. Changes how you think about limits.
It does.
Yeah.
And what's truly surprising is that abilities, once considered purely innate, like perfect pitch.
Yeah. Always heard you're born with that.
Or even those extraordinary skills you see in some individuals with savant syndrome. They're increasingly understood as acquired skills, developed through intense, focused training, not just gifts.
So people learned perfect pitch. As adults.
Studies have shown adults managing to learn perfect pitch, yes.
Yeah.
And others showed college students dramatically improving memory recall through specific training techniques. Skills can be built.
Wow. It makes you wonder how many natural talents we might have just given up on too early in ourselves, doesn't it?
It really does.
Okay, so if deliberate practice builds the structure, the scaffolding of expertise, what about those moments when experts just know? You know, that intuition. Skilled decision makers trust it, but it feels, I don't know, accidental sometimes, like a mysterious sixth sense.
Yeah, that sixth sense idea comes up a lot. But the core revelation here is that intuition, well, it isn't really mysterious at all. It's actually based on using experience to recognize important patterns, sometimes very subtle ones.
Patterns, okay.
Think about that anecdote, the one about the firefighter lieutenant.
Wrong with the sixth sense, huh. Yeah.
He pulls his crew out of what looks like a totally standard house fire just moments before the floor collapses where they were standing. No obvious clues, no visible danger yet. He just said, it didn't feel right.
And that was intuition.
It's a classic example of intuition as experience-based pattern recognition. His years of experience allowed him to subconsciously pick up on subtle cues that signaled imminent collapse, even if he couldn't articulate them rationally at that moment.
It's fascinating how much the sources emphasize intuition. But doesn't that kind of fly in the face of the usual advice, you know, trust the data, trust rational analysis, not just gut feelings or stories?
That's a really good point. And the sources aren't saying ignore data. Not at all. What they show is that trying to analyze every single factor all the time can actually make decisions worse.
Paralysis by analysis.
Exactly. And this perceptual expertise, think of nurses spotting early signs of a serious infection in premature babies. Signs that aren't obvious on the charts yet. Or paramedics sometimes anticipating a heart attack way before it happens. These skills can often be learned and defined, even if the experts themselves initially just call it intuition or experience.
So the gut feeling isn't random?
Often, no. It reveals that these seemingly unexplainable feelings often have a concrete basis, learned through deep experience with patterns, not just luck. It's teachable in many cases.
Okay, let's dig into another really interesting aspect of expert thinking. One source mentions a senior developer of training programs, right? And he secretly told a researcher, to be a good fireground commander, you need to have a rich fantasy life.
Agrees. Yeah, that's a great quote.
A rich fantasy life. Why on earth would that be important for a firefighter commander?
Well, that fantasy life is really about mental simulation.
Mental simulation, okay.
It's the ability to consciously imagine people, objects, situations, and then transform them through a sequence of steps, like playing out a little movie in your head.
Running scenarios.
Exactly. But there are surprising constraints. Our mental simulations are usually limited to Like a maximum of 3 moving parts, maybe 6 steps forward.
Only 3. That seems very limited.
It is. So experts learn to overcome this by chunking information, abstracting it, grouping details into meaningful units.
Ah, okay. So they're not tracking every little detail, but bigger concepts.
Precisely. There's an example of an analyst simulating the future of the Polish economy using just 3 core variables and a few transitions. And remarkably, he even generated these pessimistic political scenarios that turned out to be pretty accurate years later.
Just from a simple mental simulation. Wow. So what's the catch? If it's partly based on fantasy, as the quote says, can mental simulation lead us astray? Can we fool ourselves?
Oh, absolutely. It can be seriously misleading, especially when we start to explain away evidence that doesn't fit our simulation.
Like confirmation bias.
Sort of, yeah. There's that story about the physicists, right? Disoriented.
Yeah.
On Crater Lake, they see a dock.
Which doesn't exist there.
Right. Crater Lake has no docks. But instead of questioning their location, they just assume the dock must have been just built. They explained away the conflicting evidence to fit their mental map.
Until they couldn't ignore it anymore.
Exactly. That's where this idea of snapback comes in. It's like a self-correcting mechanism.
Yeah.
Eventually, enough inconsistencies pile up, and you're forced to reevaluate to realize your mental map is wrong and you need a fresh start. Like realizing you're completely lost when navigating.
Okay. But simulation can also be used proactively, right?
Definitely. There's the pre-mortem strategy. It's really powerful.
Pre-mortem? What's that?
You deliberately imagine that your plan, whatever it is, has already failed spectacularly in the future. Then you work backwards to figure out why it failed.
So you're looking for flaws before they happen.
Precisely. It helps uncover potential weaknesses you might otherwise overlook in your optimism. Apparently, Royal Dutch Shell used this very effectively, and it's also used in military planning.
Okay, here's where things get really serious and, frankly, quite sobering.
Right.
We're talking about actual real-world consequences. One of the key sources revisits the tragic shootdown of that Iranian airliner, Flight 655, by the USS Vincennes.
Yeah, a truly terrible event.
It seemed like such an inexplicable error by highly trained people in a high-tech environment.
It did. And the basic facts are, the Airbus, Flight 655, took off from a joint military-civilian airport, climbed steadily on its assigned commercial flight path.
But the Vincennes saw it differently.
Initially, yeah. Their system tagged it unknown, presumed enemy, partly because of the airport type. They assigned it track number 447-4. But then another ship nearby, the USS Sides, assigned it a different number, 4131, and the network system adopted that one.
Okay, already confusing.
Very. And the captain of the Vincennes, he actually asked for more information. He even expressed a gut feeling it wasn't a fighter jet. But ultimately, the decision was made to shoot down track 4131.
And adding to the chaos, the crew, or part of the crew, genuinely believed the aircraft was descending toward them, right? Even though the Airbus was climbing the whole time.
That's right. And part of that was confusing screen displays. They apparently lacked clear altitude trend data, making it hard to distinguish the plane's actual movement from maybe just momentary radar fluctuations or operator perception.
Now, a lot of the initial explanations pointed to simple human error, or maybe expectancy bias. They expected an attack, so they saw one.
That was the common narrative, yes.
But our sources suggest something much more complex, more systemic might have been going on.
Yeah, this is where it gets really counterintuitive again. Why did half the crew, experienced operators, genuinely see a descending aircraft when the Airbus was clearly climbing?
Right. What explains that discrepancy?
The surprising hypothesis involves a second airplane, not physically there, but in the system. It suggests a weakness in the Aegis system at the time. The computer accidentally recycled the original track number, 4474.
Recycled it?
Yeah. And assigned that same number to a completely different aircraft, a U.S. Navy A-6 Intruder, which was descending, but hundreds of miles away.
Oh, wow.
So you had the ascending Airbus correctly tracked as 4131, and this phantom track, 4474, linked to the distant descending A-6. And then adding crew members under immense stress, maybe punching in the wrong track number because the ship was pitching violently in evasive maneuvers.
So some crew members were looking at data for 4131, the Airbus.
And accurately reporting its climb.
While others might have inadvertently pulled up 44174.
And accurately reported the descent associated with that track number, thinking they were talking about the nearby threat.
Good Lord. So they weren't mistaken about what they saw on their screens. They were looking at data for two different things, thinking it was one.
That's the hypothesis.
Yeah.
So what does this all mean for us, thinking about expertise and systems? It shows how easily breakdowns in You know, data presentation, system design, communication under pressure can lead good, competent people to make catastrophic decisions.
Without just blaming bias, it's the system interacting with the humans.
Exactly. It's a much more complex picture.
It's really striking how much our sources use stories and examples, like the Vincennes, to explain these complex ideas about expertise. It feels like data alone just isn't enough sometimes.
That's a great observation.
But again, doesn't that go against the grain? We're always told to trust the cold, hard data, not just anecdotes.
Right. And again, it's not about ignoring data. But stories, the sources argue, function almost like natural experiments.
Natural experiments? How?
They link causes to effects in a really clear, memorable way. They make complex information much easier to recall and understand. Think about jurors in a trial. They don't just weigh isolated facts. They try to build a coherent story that makes sense of all the evidence.
Ah, okay. The narrative connects the dots.
Precisely. There's an analysis in one source of the Mike Tyson rape trial. The defense tried to paint a story of extortion, but that story just couldn't explain key facts, like the victim's physical injuries or her immediate reporting. It didn't hold together.
So the narrative failed.
Right. And the source even sketches out an alternative narrative, focusing maybe on the victim's naivete rather than malice, which might have been more credible because it could potentially account for more of the observed facts. And think about the absurdity of some conspiracy theories, like the JFK magic bullet theory. When you try to actually mentally simulate the plotters needing the foreknowledge to plan that exact trajectory, the narrative just falls apart. It reveals the flaws in the logic.
So stories test coherence.
Okay.
And beyond stories, we use metaphors and analogies constantly, often without even thinking about it.
All the time. And the sources make a useful distinction. Analogs are comparisons from similar domains, like comparing one battle to another. Metaphors draw from really different domains, like the classic arguments or war metaphor. Oh. If arguments are war, you attack positions, you shoot down ideas, you win or lose.
Right. That shapes how we argue.
Exactly. But what if the metaphor was different? What if arguments are like music practice?
Yeah.
Then you're not attacking. You're trying to find harmony. You're collaborating, refining. It completely changes the frame.
Never thought of it like that.
And there's a really surprising example in the sources about a tennis instructor. He stopped breaking down strokes into tiny mechanical steps. Instead, he used metaphors.
Metaphors for tennis.
Yeah. Like for a net shot, he'd say, push a pie in someone's face. For a backhand, throw a frisbee. These weren't about isolated movements. They gave a sense of the overall body coordination needed. And apparently, it worked much better.
Huh. Weirdly effective.
And analogies, they really help with predictions, especially when you don't have complete data, like trying to predict movie theater attendance in a small town where one just opened.
You'd look for similar towns.
Right. But the key, the sources stress, is selecting analogies based on shared causal dynamics, the underlying reasons things work the way they do, not just superficial similarities like town size. What makes people go to the movies in that kind of town?
Got it. Deeper similarities. Okay, let's shift gears a bit. How does all this expertise stuff play out when people work together in teams? It's not just about brilliant individuals, is it? There's something about a team mind.
Absolutely. Team decision-making has properties that go way beyond just summing up individual skills.
Like what?
One critical factor the sources highlight is communicating intent.
Intent. Meaning the why.
Exactly. Explaining the purpose, the underlying goal behind an order or an action. Not just what to do, but why you're doing it.
And why is that so important?
Because it promotes independence and enables improvisation. If people understand the intent, they can adapt intelligently when the situation changes unexpectedly, even if they can't follow the original order to the letter.
Ah, okay. They can still achieve the goal.
Right. Here's a compelling historical example. The British Navy letting the German battleship Goeben escape in the Mediterranean at the start of World War I.
How did intent fail there?
The orders were ambiguous about engaging superior forces. The British admiral interpreted this rigidly and broke off pursuit, even though stopping the Goeben was strategically crucial. He followed the letter, not the likely intent, of the orders, a huge failure.
Wow, contrast that.
Well, another source gives an example of a pilot whose clear intent for balancing fuel was initially misunderstood by his flight engineer. The engineer started transferring fuel the wrong way, creating a dangerous imbalance because he missed the pilot's underlying goal. Clear intent matters.
So this raises a big question for anyone leading a team, right? How do you foster that kind of initiative, that ability to adapt based on intent without things just falling apart into chaos.
It's a balance, for sure. The sources mention a Prussian prince back in the day who apparently expected his majors to know when not to obey his orders.
Really? Not obey?
Yeah. The emphasis was on understanding the higher goal and using their initiative, not just blindly following instructions that might be outdated or flawed in a changing situation.
Trusting their judgment.
Right. And you see this in highly effective teams today, like experienced wildland firefighting crews. Their success often comes from decades of shared experience, team stability, knowing each other's roles and capabilities, which allows for clear, rapid decision-making, even under intense pressure. They share an understanding.
Which brings us back to the Vincennes.
Exactly. Let's revisit that again. Remember when the captain asked about track 4474, the original track number?
Uh-huh.
No one in the command center corrected him to say, "Sir, the track number changed. We're tracking 4131 now."
So that initial confusion was never cleared up.
Right. That lack of shared understanding, that failure to correct a critical piece of information, crippled the team's ability to make sense of the situation, even though individual members might have had parts of the correct picture.
A communication breakdown at a crucial moment.
Absolutely. Contrast that with, say, the success story of Duke Power's Emergency Response Center. They implemented really clear expectations, streamlined communication protocols, and saw a significant improvement in performance during crises. Shared understanding was key.
Okay, we often hold up rational analysis as the gold standard for making good decisions. You know, logic, reason, data. But is it possible to be too rational? Can logic actually become a liability sometimes?
It's a fascinating question, and the sources suggest, yes, it actually can. They introduced this concept of hyper-rationality.
Hyper-rationality, what's that?
It's described almost as a mental disturbance, where someone tries to handle every single decision purely logically, breaking everything down into analytical steps. And the result is often paralysis by analysis. They just get stuck.
Thinking too much.
Yeah. One way to think about it is that rational thinking is like our foveal vision, really sharp and excellent for focusing on fine details right in front of us.
Okay.
But you also need peripheral vision, that broader awareness, that intuition to know where to focus your detailed analysis in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Hyper-rationality is like having only the foveal vision, losing the bigger picture.
And what are the limits of just pure rational analysis?
Well, the sources point out several. Rules are often ambiguous in the real world. Calculations rely on subjective judgments about what factors to include and how to weight them. You run into combinatorial explosions, just too many options to analyze fully, like trying to map out every chess move.
Right, it becomes impossible quickly.
And crucially, trying too hard to be purely rational can actually interfere with your intuitive thinking, shutting down those valuable pattern recognition skills we talked about earlier.
So if being hyper-rational is a potential problem, what's the alternative when you're facing complex situations that don't just fit neatly into a logical spreadsheet?
Well, there's that wonderful little story about finding a missing contact lens.
Contact lens.
Yeah.
Okay.
The husband starts this very methodical, rational search grid patterns on the floor, logical deduction, gets nowhere.
Sounds like me.
Agrees.
Right.
But his wife takes a different approach, more intuitive. She uses mental simulation, tries to reconstruct the sequence of events leading up to the loss. Where was I standing? What did I do next? Kind of like Inspector Maigret piecing together a crime.
Building a narrative.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And by running that mental movie, that narrative, she figures out the likely spot and boom, finds the lens.
So intuition and narrative trumped pure logic.
In that case, yes. It highlights that in messy natural settings, pure consistency is rare. We're constantly dealing with incomplete information, contradictions, uncertainty. Expertise isn't always about finding the single rational answer.
And it's worth noting, expertise isn't easily gained everywhere, right? Some domains are harder than others.
Absolutely. Things like stock picking, long-term public policy, even child rearing.
Mm-hmm.
These are tough domains for building reliable expertise.
Why is that?
Because they're highly dynamic, human behavior is unpredictable, feedback on your decisions is often delayed or ambiguous, and you rarely get identical situations repeating perfectly.
Mm.
It's not like firefighting or flying, where patterns are more stable and feedback is often immediate.
Right. Different kinds of problems.
And there's a really interesting, almost radical perspective from a researcher named Rasmussen mentioned in the sources. Instead of trying to build ever more complex defenses against human error in systems.
Yeah.
Design the systems to make malfunctions more visible, more obvious. Basically, trust the competence of the human operators to detect and manage problems if they can actually see them clearly.
Interesting. Make failure transparent.
Yeah. Rely on the expertise. Don't try to eliminate the human.
This has been a really, really insightful deep dive. It feels like we've peeled back some layers on what expertise truly is.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff.
We've seen it's this dynamic acquired skill. It's built through that tough, deliberate practice, through experiencing real-world consequences. It's not just about having some innate talent or putting in the time.
Right. It's an active process.
And it involves this rich interplay of intuition, that pattern recognition and mental simulation, using stories, using analogies wisely, all balanced with but not dominated by rational analysis.
And I think if we connect this back to the bigger picture, the real value here is understanding these different sources of power, as one source calls them, so you can consciously think about applying them in your own life, your own work.
How so?
Well, maybe start paying closer attention to how experts around you perceive situations. What patterns do they see? How do effective teams actually voice and blend their diverse experiences? And just take some time to reflect on your own thought processes. Are you relying too much on one mode?
Becoming more aware of how you think.
Exactly. Self-awareness about these cognitive tools.
Okay, so as you, our listener, reflect on all this, here's maybe a final provocative thought to leave you with. What invisible things, those subtle patterns, those causal dynamics, are you currently seeing or perhaps missing in your own experiences? And how can you consciously start to refine your own sources of power, your intuition, your simulations, your storytelling, your analysis to better navigate the complexities of your world?